Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. First of all, I'm really sorry that we've been absent over the past few months. When the lockdown in the UK started, it seemed like a good moment for us to press pause, partly to free up a little bit of headspace. But I know that also this time has probably been one which, for British citizens living in Europe, has aggravated the uncertainties that Brexit might have introduced to your lives. And just to say, my thoughts and those of our team are with you. And at the same time, I know that while the news cycle may have turned away from Brexit, the clock is ticking and negotiations between the UK and EU that impact on citizens' rights have been continuing. With this in mind, I thought that relaunching the podcast might be an opportune moment for us to talk to someone who knows everything there is to know about the negotiations and where we're at with the rights of British citizens living in the EU. And I'm absolutely delighted to welcome Jane Goulding, who is a lawyer specialising in EU law and happens to be the co-chair of British in Europe, onto the podcast to give you a little bit of a lowdown. So hello, Jane.
Hello, Michala, and thank you very much for inviting me, and I hope I'll live up to your expectations.
I'm sure that you will. I'm sure you will not disappoint. Jane, do you want to start by giving me a little bit of a sense of the journey that you and British in Europe have been on since you first came together in 2016?
Yeah, very happy to do that. I mean, I'll start by saying who we are. We're a grassroots citizens rights group coalition founded in early 2017. And the idea was to give UK citizens living, working and studying across the EU a voice in the Brexit negotiations. And before I start saying anything about our journey, I think it's important for me to explode a couple of myths. We're around 1.2 to 3 million of us living across the EU. And nearly 80% of us are working age or younger, although obviously there is a significant minority who are retired. And the final thing is that the majority of us, over 60%, did not have a say in the EU referendum in 2016.
That's really helpful, Jane. I mean, those are myths that we've been working really hard to counter ourselves over the course of the project. And I think that it's always good to remind people of exactly who you are. I suppose, in a way, I was wondering if we could start the discussion of your journey by talking about, I suppose, the challenges of actually coming together as a group, given that actually one of the other things, given that we've exploded those myths, is that the British citizen population living in the EU is actually highly economically and socially integrated. And so it's not necessarily the case that you're all just hanging around with one another anyway on a day-to-day basis.
No, that's absolutely right, Michala. And yes, I mean, this coalition is unprecedented. Before British in Europe existed, there was no EU-wide citizens grouping for British citizens living in the EU. Because as you say, we're all very integrated in the countries we live in. For example, here in Germany, where I live, I didn't actually know any British people until I got involved in the pre-referendum work that we did here in Germany. And so there were a number of disparate groups across the EU. There are a number of groups who are already working on Votes for Life, because I don't know if everybody knows, but after 15 years abroad, British citizens lose their right to vote back in the UK. So there were quite a number of groups already campaigning on that issue, but not really very joined up. And then before the referendum, some groups set up to run referendum events to inform British citizens about what it meant for them. So we did this in Germany. We did a lot of events here in Germany. And then after the referendum, other groups sprung up as a reaction to the result, obviously, which was then going to affect very seriously the rights of UK citizens living in the EU. So we were a bunch of disparate groups back in 2016. And we started having some conference calls in the autumn of 2016. But things really came together after the group here in Germany submitted written evidence to the Exiting the EU Select Committee of the UK Parliament. And we were then asked to provide oral evidence. And what we did then was to go out to the other groups on one of these conference calls and asked if we could all work together on this. We did that. And we organised a group of people to give evidence in January 2017, and British in Europe was born. Plus, it cemented our partnership or relationship with the 3 million. And that is what led to the 3 million and British in Europe having their first meeting with Michel Barnier in March 2017, the day before Article 50 was notified.
I think that's really important, both in terms of establishing how UK citizens living in the EU kind of come together around this particular issue because of what it means around the transformation of their rights, but also that kind of coming together with the other side of the citizens' rights negotiations, those EU citizens in the EU. Because whatever your position on Brexit, and I know that there's a variety of positions on Brexit among British citizens who live in the EU, it's completely incontestable that this changes your rights. This changes your legal rights.
Absolutely. And for us from the beginning, because of our partnership with the 3 million and for the 3 million who are the largest group representing EU citizens in the UK, this was a citizens' rights issue. It was a citizens' rights campaign. It wasn't about one group or the other. And that's why we've worked so closely all the way through. And I think the fact that we have worked closely has been very much appreciated, particularly by the European Parliament and our supporters there.
That's a really nice potted history of British in Europe from the early days. Well, actually, probably for about the first 6 months to a year of your journey. And I think it's really important that we remember this moment. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring you onto the podcast as well, because it is unprecedented for British citizens living across Europe to come together on an issue other than the Vote for Life, which was always quite a marginal issue until the referendum, I would say. I just wondered if you could kind of bring us up to 2020. I mean, I realise that so much has happened in that time.
Yeah, so much has happened. I can hardly believe the journey we've been through, quite honestly, since that first evidence session back in January 2017. I mean, since then, effectively, we've become the organisation of reference on citizens' rights for UK citizens in the EU. We're the largest coalition of groups across the EU. And we're recognised now as trusted interlocutors by the UK government, the European Commission, the EU Council, the European Parliament. And we've also carried out extensive advocacy at national level across the EU. And we inputted into every single round of the negotiations. And we were debriefed by both sides on the negotiation of the withdrawal agreement. Plus, we then commented on every successive draft of the withdrawal agreement. So we've moved on since then. We then had a year and a half where it wasn't clear whether the withdrawal agreement was going to be ratified. And so attention switched from the withdrawal agreement to no deal contingency plans. And that was a very, very worrying and uncertain time for our members. Ultimately, of course, the withdrawal agreement has now been ratified. So our goal now is to ensure the smooth, timely, and fair implementation of the withdrawal agreement. Also, along the way on this journey, we've somehow become a pan-European movement, in fact, because we now have groups, including some of them quite small groups, but nevertheless groups in most EU countries. There are only a couple that we don't actually cover now. And so that's all a big challenge.
And I think this is really, really important. This is volunteer work. No one is paying you to do this. You're all doing this on top of your day jobs in most cases. So it's kind of a labour of love in lots of ways.
Yeah, it is. I mean, we are grassroots volunteers first and foremost, and our campaign is founded on legal advocacy because we have a number of lawyers, including myself, in our steering team. But we are a 10-strong steering team who most of us, as you say, have day jobs and are doing this on top of our day jobs. We have managed to fundraise and have some limited funding, but we are by no means a professional NGO or a civil society organisation. We are still fundamentally volunteers.
I mean, obviously, as one of the scholars working on the issue of UK citizens living in the EU in a time of Brexit, I'm completely sold on the need for an organisation such as yours. But perhaps it would be useful to spell out quite clearly why you think this type of advocacy is necessary and important at this time.
Well, it's extremely important for different reasons. I mean, first of all, the implementation of the withdrawal agreement. We feel that this needs to be monitored. Obviously, the European Commission will be responsible for monitoring how the withdrawal agreement is implemented. But we have groups on the ground, so we can feed back into the process and talk about problems that our members may be having. Now, unfortunately, we haven't really got to that stage yet because we haven't got to the stage really where very much implementation is taking place across the EU 26. So while UK settled status may have thrown up all sorts of problems for EU citizens in the UK, it's at least up and running. Whereas in the majority of EU 26 countries, the systems are not in place yet. So at the moment, because we haven't seen very much implementation, we can only anticipate possible problems that there may be in the future with implementation. So we're in a situation that's probably over a year behind that of EU citizens in the UK in terms of implementation. There are about five countries so far that have started implementing. There are a number of countries that have published draft legislation, but there are some countries that have not yet. And even in the countries where the draft legislation has been published, there's not necessarily clarity about the final version of that draft legislation or the timeline for actually implementing it.
I mean, I know that in 2018, as a project team, we co-authored a report with Migration Policy Institute, which argued very strongly that the EU member states needed to lay out and needed to start planning for how they were going to implement these things. But it's clear that 2 years later, we're still a little bit at sea with that question of how this will be implemented.
Yeah, sorry to interrupt, but it's partly because of the no-deal contingency planning. Obviously, that took precedence over the withdrawal agreement. It's to do with the legal framework, because obviously in a no-deal situation, the legal framework was going to be very different for British citizens, because it would then fall to the member states to decide how to deal with us as third country nationals. Whereas under the withdrawal agreement, you have a framework set at EU level.
The other thing is that, I mean, I think that people who listen to the podcast understand what this means in terms of a transformation of rights, but they might not quite understand the difference between the situations that they're in at the moment, where they might be being asked to go and register or apply for particular forms of documentation, and the kind of eventual implementation. For example, when I think about this, I often think about the case of British people in France being told to go and get a carte de séjour as EU citizens at this point in time. But eventually that will be replaced with something else. But I think that that's the bit that people are less sure about, for the obvious reasons that it's less clear as well.
So. Yeah, it's less clear. Well, you know, the member states under the withdrawal agreement had two options of how they would implement the withdrawal agreement. They could either decide to go for what's a constitutive system, which means applying for your status under the withdrawal agreement, and therefore your status will depend on a decision of the authorities, or they could continue with the current system, which is called declaratory, where your rights derive directly from the agreement, and any decision on providing you with documentation to confirm this is simply that, it's confirming a status that you already have. So that's already a big difference. And about half of the member states have actually decided to go for the former system, where your status will actually be dependent on a decision of the authorities on your application. And the same conditions will apply as apply now under EU law as EU citizens. So you'll have to be able to show that you were legally resident and that you were exercising free movement rights. For example, you're employed, self-employed, or you have sufficient resources to support yourself, or you're studying and have sufficient resources. So it'll be the same conditions and interpreted, we hope, although we don't know yet because we haven't got that far with the implementation. We hope they will be applied in exactly the same way. And that is one of the concerns that we have, because we haven't seen any very much implementation so far. But there will be an application to be made in those systems. In a declaratory system, all you will need to do is, if you want a document to prove your status, then you will have to register to apply to get that document.
That's really helpful. Thank you very much, Jane. I mean, obviously, implementation is one part of this, but I know that as a group, you've also been very vocal about what the withdrawal agreement does not cover in respect to citizens' rights. And I think it would be really useful to just kind of give the headlines of this that people need to be aware of.
Yeah, and that was going to be my second point about why it is important for there to be an organisation that is monitoring implementation, but also defending the citizens' rights of UK citizens in the EU. This is absolutely true. The majority only of our rights will be safeguarded in the host state where we live now only, not outside of the country where we live now. So that means that we will lose our rights of free movement across the EU. We will also lose EU-wide recognition of professional qualifications, which is, of course, very important ancillary to EU-wide free movement. And we, in the withdrawal agreement, cross-border working is not covered for UK citizens either. And in actual fact, what is disappointing is that third country nationals who are not covered by the withdrawal agreement, other third country nationals who have applied and obtained long-term residence under EU law, have greater mobility rights than we do under the withdrawal agreement, because we don't have any mobility rights. So that's a big issue for us, because the permanent residence status that we will acquire after 5 years legal residence under the withdrawal agreement is really the equivalent to this EU long-term residence for third country nationals. And yet we will not have mobility rights attached to our status.
I think that this shows really clearly, this is a kind of, it maintains your rights, as you said, in your nation state. So it maintains your right to remain where you are, and your rights to continue working there, to be settled, but it doesn't permit, and your rights to have the qualifications recognised in the state in which you live, that's right, isn't it?
Only if you've already had a specific recognition decision before end of transition, or you're in the process of getting one. If you're in the process of getting one, you can continue after end of transition under the current rules. But you will have to get a specific recognition decision either before end of transition or start the process before end of transition to ensure that you can keep using your professional qualifications, even in the country where you live now.
That's a really helpful clarification there as well. I mean, I think all of this shows how exactly what's being unravelled and what the potential fallout could be, which is why, of course, you're continuing with the advocacy work that you're doing. Is there anything else that you'd like to add around the kind of monitoring of implementation of the withdrawal agreement around citizens' rights? Because we've spoken quite a lot of length about that, but there might be other things that you wanted to introduce. piece there.
Yeah, I mentioned briefly the conditions. I mean, obviously, we would like to see the conditions for legal residents being applied as they are applied now to us as EU citizens, because some countries apply them more strictly than others as well. And we don't want to see retrospectively people being subject to stricter conditions than they would have been in the past. So that's one thing. And then we're also a bit concerned about the residence card, because the European Commission put out an implementing decision which sets out a standard format for the residence card that we will receive under the withdrawal agreement. But it doesn't make any distinction between whether you've got ordinary residence or you've already acquired permanent residence. And that's important, because you need to be able to prove that in many different situations. For example, if you need to leave the country for more than a couple of years, for example, you have the right to leave for up to 5 years under the withdrawal agreement without losing your permanent residence. In some countries, you need to prove that you've got permanent residence in order to have access to free healthcare, for example, in Italy. Also, it's just the fact that you don't want to have to keep continually being asked to prove that you are legally resident and have exercised free movement rights after the 5 year period.
So you're trying to stop the gaps before they start to show in lots of ways.
Exactly. Anticipate the problems, because we all know that implementing EU law at regional and local level can often cause problems, because you need to have the right documentation when you're sitting in front of an official behind a desk in the local office.
Definitely, definitely. Can I fast forward a little bit? Because now we're obviously all in lockdown, which I think has for you meant a lot less travel, because I know that you were doing a lot of travel for the advocacy work that you were doing. But I wondered about the kind of impact of COVID-19 on British citizens living in the EU. I mean, we know that the way that Brexit has been experienced has been quite uneven. And I just wondered what you were hearing from your members about how COVID-19 is impacting, particularly on their concerns about their rights.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, it is causing a lot of concerns among our members, because they're worried about the impact that the COVID-19 crisis will have on their ability to demonstrate that they're exercising free movement rights and that they're eligible for the status under the withdrawal agreement. Particularly if they're suffering financially, then they may be worried that they will have problems showing that they have reached a minimum income or that they have sufficient resources in order to live in the country where they are, is their host country currently. Then there are others who may have got stranded somewhere and can't get back to their host country, and they're worried about whether they will get back in time or what impact this will have on their residence rights. There are other people who were planning to move, and now they're worried whether they'll be able to move in time before the end of transition. And overall, generally, there are inevitably going to be delays with implementation, which is another reason why it is important that there is timely implementation, because the clock is ticking, particularly as a result of this crisis. There are inevitably going to be backlogs, and that is going to impact our members. I mean, we worry particularly about young people, especially if they're studying in another country. You know, delays in citizenship applications and residency applications may affect them particularly badly. And so it really is a concern for us as to whether, particularly in the constitutive systems where there's a deadline to apply by June 2021, where the member states should now be considering extending those deadlines. And also, just generally, we would like to ask member states to give our members reassurances that there will be a generous approach taken in terms of how the crisis has impacted people's ability to fulfil the conditions. Overall, I think, obviously, our view is that extending transition would, of course, solve a lot of these problems. But I don't know how likely that is at this stage.
I think that that's a really good point. What you're calling for is specifically for member states to take a generous approach to the implementation, that this is directed at the member states who now have responsibility for helping these UK citizens to make sure that they're best in the best possible position they can be given the terms of the withdrawal agreement by that kind of end date for implementation. So that's really, really helpful, Jane. Is there anything else that you wanted to add?
No, I think I've probably said nearly everything. I mean, I think the overall message that we have is, and we've made this point to the European Parliament, we spoke on a webinar with the EU-UK Friendship Group at the end of April. The overall message is really that we ask and call upon the Member States and the European Parliament and European Commission to pay more attention to implementation as regards UK citizens in the EU. We don't think enough attention has been paid today. We think that now there is movement as far as that is concerned, but we would urge them to pay more attention to implementation because the clock really is ticking now and there is not very long until the end of transition and certainly not until June 2021, which is the deadline in constitutive systems, which is half of the member states.
Thank you very much, Jane. That's been absolutely fascinating. So thank you for joining me.
It was a pleasure. Thank you very much, Michaela, as always.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast with me, Dr. Michaela Benson. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so by searching for Brexit Brits Abroad on iTunes and Libsyn. And to join in the conversation, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BrexpatsEU, and you can visit our Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. To find out more about the project, visit our brand new website, that's brexitbritsabroad.org. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.